Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have a lot to talk about this hour, we're going to really focus on roots. I don't know how many of you saw the opening episode last night, but a lot of buzz about it. We watched it at home. I missed a basketball game to watch it, but I watched it because I wanted to see it. And also we were thinking, reflecting back on 40 years ago, when the first Roots came out and the effect that had on the society. And there's been a lot of arguments that I've seen that my dear friend Jared Ball and I have been going back and forth on Facebook about how important or not important Roots is. And he has his interesting analysis that I'll bring up in the part of this conversation. But the profound effect some people think it had 40 years ago, beginning to change the nature of how we think of the American narrative, which was controlled by Gone with the Wind and Birth of a Nation, and beginning to open that up. And did that really happen? What does all that mean? Well, let me introduce our guest so we can jump right into it. Dr. David Zurwick, who is a Sun's media critic and assistant professor in the Department of Communications and Media Studies at Goucher College, who I go back a long way with on radio. Good to have you back, Dave.
I enjoy it. The theme song brought back memories. It's one of my favorite songs. I love that song.
There we go. Carla Wills joins us, senior news producer at Democracy Now!, always with a lot of interesting thoughts of her own as well. Carla, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
And Dr. Melissa Spence joins us also by Skype, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book, Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Of course, he wrote Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. And Lester, good to have you here.
Hey, it's good to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number to call in. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. Log on to the Facebook pages. I'll check those out in a moment as well. But do call in, 410-319-8888. So I assume everybody here at this table saw. Well, I know you get them in advance.
Yes, I saw them all 8 hours.
It's all 8 hours. So Lester and Carla, I assume you saw them last night.
I saw it this morning. That's my priority straight up the game last night.
I got you. I watched the end of the game last night. It was a great series.
It was a great series, but I saw it last night.
Okay, yeah. So, but let's go back a bit to 1976, 77.
It debuted in 77. The novel appeared in 76.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I remember that very well. When it came out, we actually bought our first color television because Roots came out. We wanted to watch it in color. I remember that. And then the entire group of people, like 20 people, gathered in our living room because nobody had color TV. We were the first one in our crew to have a color television. Everybody came over and watched it together as a family. Kids watched it. Everybody gathered around to watch this thing, Roots, after most of us had read the book the year before. So But some people say we're making too much of the profound impact and effect that original series had. Let me just start there. David, let me let you start and go around the room.
Well, you know, I was covering pop culture for the Detroit Free Press in 1977 when it came out. And probably one of the most important results of this is, and my wife was the television critic at the Free Press, and for about four or five years, programmers at the three networks, and it was a three-network universe primarily then, ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS was, you know, Lyndon Johnson sort of was just starting. It didn't have the strength that it does now, but or now it's in a little bit of a decline, but that it had at its peak. And network programmers, network executives, people at the level of executive vice presidents in charge of programming would say to critics like us and reporters like us, we'd say, well, why aren't there more programs featuring characters, persons of color, either as actors or characters, people of color? And they'd say, we can't do it. White audiences will not watch shows with black stars and black actors in the lead. Now, as you know from my book, they also said that about Jews, and these were Jews saying it. The Jewish programmers were saying it about Jews. Network television was crazy because they catered so much to Madison Avenue, and they let Madison Avenue tell them how to do. So one of the most important results, I think, of the success of Roots in 1977 is that it told the public what a lie the networks had been promulgating in saying they couldn't put on shows with black characters in the lead. This blew that out of the water. And that made a difference. That made a difference in a real level way in terms of the kinds of programs that came on television. In the industry of Hollywood, in the kinds of shows that got funded for an initial script that were put, then made, got a pilot and then put into production. So you did see that increase afterwards, and I think that's important. Now, you got a lot of bad shows, too, as you always do with commercial television. You get a lot of bad shows with persons of color in the league, but you also got some good ones. That's one big change. I think the other change, anytime you get a show, and it could be for better or worse, but when 80 million people, as was the audience for that last night of Roots, the eighth night, sit down and watch something, and in those days watch it in the same time frame, I think that's, you know, we over-romanticize the shared experience of television in the old days because each of us watches it from our own social location. So it's a quasi-shared or mediated shared experience. But that's a powerful statement, and it did then generate a discussion about race. I don't know how informed that discussion was, you know. I came back, you know, 39 or 40 years later now and looked at this version, and my major reaction, my initial reaction was not so much about the series but about me. I thought, man, you know, when I watched that in 77, I didn't realize that Alex Haley. The author, had flipped the captivity narrative on its head. I mean, one of the earliest ways that European and white culture taught racism was with the captivity narrative in colonial America. European white settlers being captured by Native Americans, horrible things being done to them by these quote-unquote savages. This story says, no, you know who the savages were? I'll show you. It's the slave traders. It's the white plantation owners. That's savage behavior, and persons of color are the victims of that. That, to me, is a powerful. You're taking one of the most fundamental racist narratives of American life, and you're trying to deal with it. I don't know how different people read it, what different meaning they make out of it. That's why we have arguments about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But in terms of Alex Haley doing that in the script, I didn't appreciate it. I missed that in 77. This time around, I saw it immediately, and it grabbed me.
So Carla, can you reflect back on that moment, and then before we turn to Lester?
In 77? Yeah. You know what was interesting, and I only read this. I'm getting terrible feedback.
Is a lot. Maybe you should try phone.
Yeah, exactly. I only read this recently because of the remake coming out now. When I read the book after seeing the actual series, because I was much, much younger, but I read the book, I think maybe I was in high school by the time I read the book. But when it first came out, you know, of course, we all were in our living rooms watching it, and it was, you know, that where the whole family watches it, and then you try to figure out how you deal with all this new information when you go to school the next day. But one of the things I read recently because of the remake is that David Wolper, who was the producer of this series, you know, the original Roots, did a real masterful thing in casting the slave owners, the masters, the slave traders, in the original series. One of the things that was really striking about it is that he cast the folks who were, you know, like heroes or your favorite, you know, fathers in series, like Robert Reed from the Brady Bunch or Lauren Green, or, you know, those folks who weren't bad guys. They weren't bad guys in our, you know, in television or movies or anything. They were good guys, but they put them in these positions to be these, you know, slave masters who did horrendous things to folks. And that made everyone get, like David was talking about turning something on his head. That's something else that turned it on his head. It just showed how everyone was complicit in this atrocity. So it wasn't that there were, you know, the good white guys and the bad white guys. Every person who was a part of this, of slavery and the slave trade, they were complicit in one of the most horrendous experiences in the country. And so that was something else that struck me now looking back at it.
And Lester?
Yeah, it's important for folk who may not, you know, who may be younger than all the people on the show. More people watched Roots, I believe, than any other thing that had appeared like it on television. So to reiterate that, really, there are a whole set of narratives about what black people would and wouldn't, would, no, I'm sorry, what white people would and wouldn't watch. I mean, so I began talking about the fact that I watched the game. It's important to note that the National Basketball Association Finals of 1979 was preempted. So you wouldn't watch the game in real time. You watch the game like 3-4 hours after, because people felt that white people really wouldn't want to watch basketball players. So what Roots did was begin to kill kind of a myth that still existed like 3-4 years later in basketball and other similar in other programming. But secondarily, I mean, not secondarily, but secondly, on the flip side of that, I was out living outside of Detroit when the film appeared. And we were just, the city of Detroit was just 4 years into being black run, you know, into the Coleman Young's first mayoral term was just about to end in 1977. So this was a period of nascent black political power, and what Roots represented was that nascent black political power being transformed into a certain cultural power, right? To wit, that there were still scholars at that time that were arguing that slavery was actually a beneficial thing and that black people actually benefited from slavery and that they were dragged into civilization, right? What that did was change the cultural narrative almost overnight, where it's really difficult to make that argument after watching Roots. And then finally, the title of, and I know some people have questions about this, or there's probably argument about this. I believe the title of Roots is Roots in American Family, right? That whole concept, while at the same time, it's important to note that the African-American experience is different. What Alex Haley does by centering the American, by having the American without the hyphen, is actually suggesting what he does with that, with Roots, is he's stating that what America is begins with the black, with black families. What happens with black families as they're taken from Africa? That actually is the primary immigrant narrative that makes America what it was, not the narrative of European settlers coming over and making their way.
Those are really important points to make here.
Wow, yeah.
Very powerful points to make. And yeah. I think that, you know, one of the things, and I'll come back to some of these, one of the things that struck me about watching last night's piece, which was different than what I remember watching back in the 70s, and I think I've watched it one other time since. I was trying to watch it this week, but I never got around to watching the past episodes like I want, as I wanted to. However, was that the depiction in this Roots, new Roots, of the Mandinka Society, of what was happening in that territory as an urban center, and especially when the son was talking about, no, I want to go to Timbuktu to do all this other kind of learning, which those pieces in this set up a much different narrative about the power and depth of various African cultures, focusing on the Mandinka, obviously. But I thought that was something, Carla, that struck me was very different.
Very different. And that was the first thing that struck me as different. And I remember before it came on, I was saying what I really appreciated about the first Roots is that they did spend a lot of time in Jufere and setting up, just showing the beauty, the culture, you know, the humanity of the people, how powerful their connections were, all of that. And I hope that this new one will do the same. Well, what I think changed a little bit is maybe they didn't spend quite as much time there, but they set it up in this context. I mean, the first words of Lawrence Fishburne in the series is when he talks about this great village of Jufere on the banks of the Gambi Bolongo being, you know, and that they traded slaves like
other, you know, great civilizations like the Greeks and the Romans, they also traded slaves. And so he set it all up that way. So you're already thinking, okay, we're talking about an advanced, you know, culture, civilization and people. And then, you know, like you said, you know, and after Kunta Kinte goes through his celebration of manhood, you know, how he wants to go to, you know, the university in Timbuktu and, you know, the whole, I mean, it was like, wow, they're really establishing that this is a great, you know, civilization and that, you know, that this is where it all started before anyone arrives here on these shores. So that was powerful.
It was. And I think the organized society part of it was really powerful, especially if you understand the history, which they didn't get into, just the history of the reality that the majority of slave revolts in the Western Hemisphere were led by people who were Muslims and enslaved because they came from organized society and organized things in a certain way that allowed them to lead the rebellions in a fashion, almost like a warlike fashion, that didn't happen with others. Because they didn't say that in this thing. But knowing the history, I mean, I could feel there was a different turning here that I thought was really important. I'm curious what to do with the rest of it. But what were you thinking, David, before we turn back to Lester?
No, I absolutely was. I was very impressed with that opening. I was also impressed with something about that. There's an interest in Kunta Kinte in doing the things, it's exactly what was just said about wanting to go to the university and his parents wanting them to go into warfare, essentially. But it's also in culture how you have to get the young men and the young women now. You have to get them to believe enough in your culture to go and fight for it to make the culture survive. And in a way, you see that threat from the outside that they face. But it is... You know, this is the other thing that seems so brilliant about this overall narrative, is you do have this hero quest. Kunta Kinte is, in a way, the hero on this. And you have to leave a place and go off into these battles in that journey. And the Jufre is so idyllic and so righteous compared to what's going on in America. You know, he sees this young woman. He's also at an age where they're thinking about marriage and things like that. And their relationship seems so sort of, and it's just budding. You don't really get into it, but it seems they're playful when he throws that fish up out of the water onto the beach and she laughs at him. It seems like a natural kind of righteous relationship. And then you get to the New World and you see how horribly romance and sexuality was distorted and abused by excessive power, by evil use of power in the way that relationships are then forged. And again, I think that's a powerful, powerful commentary on American life because, of course, we're all sold this version of America, you know, God anointed and blah, blah, blah. No, Africa looks a lot better in this story, and I couldn't agree more.
Well, I would say one thing very quickly is that before, you know, you were talking about him, you know, either going off to study or, you know, his father wanting him to go into war. Remember what they said during the manhood ceremony was the most important thing for a Mandinka warrior to do is to marry and have a family.
Yes.
And build his nation. That was more important than war because what his father said about war is easy to go into war, it's harder to get out of it.
That was the line he used. Lester, why don't you leap in here?
Yeah, just two things. So one thing, what struck me about those dynamics was one of the things that I recognize this time around is that the worship of Islam is actually also an introduction into African societies in a lot of times through conquest and slavery, right? So that kind of complicates, it shows a lot of variance between African nations, and then it implies that secondarily, one of the dynamics that was going on in in Black America at the time, something we're still living with, as well as in intellectual circles, is a set of questions about the Black family, about what its status is, about what its role is in keeping Black people back and in keeping society back. And one of the central arguments at the time was that it was Black family cultural dysfunction that was keeping Black people back, and at best, that cultural dysfunction was actually created by slavery. So you actually see that a little bit implied in that first episode, and to the extent we need to think about what Roots does for us now versus 1977, I think it'd be interesting to see to the extent to which it pushes back against that narrative, because that narrative has actually been pretty hurtful and it's empirically wrong.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's why I'm very curious to see what the rest of these episodes do, and once this series is finished, I'm very curious to have an in-depth conversation about what we've all seen. The only person who's seen them all so far among us is David Zerwick.
And I'll give nothing away, no spoilers to your audience. Listen. Last night I was sitting on I live in Hamilton about 8 blocks from here, and I was sitting on my porch. My wife and I were working. My wife was working in the front yard. I was sitting on my porch, as one of my neighbors pointed out. But a good neighbor came by Ed and said, "Zerwick, you know, I read this review about Roots, but Game 7, come on." I said, "Well, what are you going to do, Ed?" He said, "I'm going to watch Game 7. Sheila, his wife's going to be upstairs watching Roots, and we're going to keep running up and down between the two." When Lester said he had to watch the game, and Carla said she watched, I think this was going on all over America.
I watched the end of the game.
And that's what we didn't have in 1970.
That's right. That's right. Good point.
So we watched the game, which you had to watch in real time. And then see Roots. He came on back-to-back like 3 times on the History Channel last night. So you could totally do it. Okay. And like 3 other cable networks.
So when's it? I don't know this. This sounds like a silly question where we go to break. I'm going to open the phones to Chris. And Chris and Adube and Ernest, your next callers up. We're going to come to your calls, 410-319-8888. But so when's the next episode? Is it tonight or next week?
Yeah, each night. Each night. 4 nights straight, 2 hours each.
4 nights
straight.
That's
right. But the right caller's right. They're airing them in rotation, and you can see them on Lifetime. You can see them on History. You can see them on the A&E channel. So you can tune in pretty much any time and probably find an episode if you check the listing.
I think it's important.
You can see it online anytime.
Yes. or that thing called the Internet. Thank you.
That's how I watch it. I watch it online.
Okay, so I do want to explore, when we come back from this break, after we get to the phones, about what did the original Roots change the nature of media at all, and what's been produced, and looking now at this kind of series of films and TV shows that have come out. I'm thinking about Underground, which I watched that series. I don't watch a lot of TV on anymore, but I watched Underground. And what this dynamic shift is happening. And also, there's a lot of argument being made by other people I've been talking to, writing back and forth over the last couple of days, which is that this is just a slave narrative without any substance in terms of a critique of capitalism or how slavery engendered it, and we never can get to that in film. So I want to wrestle with those two things when we come back a little bit for this quick break, and also get the phone. A lot of people calling in, so we have a lot of calls to get to as well. We'll be right back as we explore the new series Roots. Opening day was last night. Watch it tonight, and then next week we'll have a postmortem after you have a chance to watch the whole thing. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Mark Steiner here with Carla Wills, senior news producer at Democracy Now!, Dr. Lester Spence, associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Knocking the Hustle, and David Zerwick, Baltimore Sun media critic and assistant professor in the Department of Communication and Media Studies at Goucher College, and you at 410-319-8888. Let's go right to the phones and then come and have our guest respond, 410-319-8888. Chris, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Mark. I love your show. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
All right. My comment is a quick comment. It's just, you know, me personally, you know, it's possibly a good thing that they, you know, they're trying to re-portray Roots on TV. But I remember when Roots first came out. I was born in 1977. I was a child, and I remember when Roots would come out for a week, right? And they would play that the entire week, but then they would play Shaka Zulu too. And then this is my point though. Shaka Zulu portrays the black African male as royalty. And Roots, like all of these other big money films that white people choose to put out, the box office chooses to put out, are all about slaves and Marion and Pappy and all of this type of stuff. But what you could bring back Roots, but the same person who thought to bring back Roots was exposed to Shaka Zulu. Why wouldn't you bring back Shaka Zulu, which portrayed, and I think black people need that more now than ever, that portrays black people as royalty before we even came to the Western Hemisphere as slaves. You see what I'm saying?
Alessio, let me let you jump in that first.
Yeah, I think that's I think a lot of people probably share the brother's sentiment. My own point is that if I were to just to focus, for example, on my own family, on the Spences from, say, 1910 to now, where you got family suffering from Jim Crow, then family suffering from Northern racism, I can find enough stuff in there to give me everything I need culturally. Now, the argument implied in that comment is that somehow what black people need to see is kings and queens, in part to deal with this cultural dysfunction that we that we're dealing with. I don't agree that we have a cultural dysfunction problem. I think we have a racism problem, and that dynamic is on whites. To that extent, what we need to see is American history and to see how black folk have altered American dynamics and how American dynamics have helped shape what it means to be black. I mean, I actually remember Shaka Zulu. I think I'd be all down for a remake of that, but we're here in America, and if I have to choose, I would much rather see all types of stories told about slavery, about that specific moment, than I would something that happened off continent.
And my remembrance is watching Shaka Zulu also, Carla, was it that too was really a white film.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, and the other thing I would also push back on is just that I think it's, for me, more powerful if I want to draw references from African society. For me, it's more powerful to see the village and the sophistication of the families and the people in Jufere than focus on African royalty. To me, that just speaks more to me just directly than anything else.
Yeah, I think the issue of how we wrestle with the enslavement of African people and the genocide of Native people that actually allowed room for plantations to be built for the enslavement of African people in this hemisphere, and how that is at the very root of capitalism itself. Without it, there would be no modern capitalism. Yeah. I mean, Lester, to me, one of the things we have to do is, Roots doesn't get into that, but I think that's the next level of conversation that has to happen.
So I'm reading a book, last night, before the game came on, called Democracy Against Capitalism, right? It's basically about making an argument that political structures are really important to understand capitalism as economic structures are. And I'm looking in the index, and it's a great book. I'm looking at index, and they have maybe two or three pages about slavery and maybe two or three pages about race. And it's like a 400-page book, right? If we allow for the argument that pieces of popular culture are supposed to speak to the present, then the question really is what do we need now in a remake of Roots? We don't need the same stuff we needed in 1977. We were just 4 years out from black people being able to elect representatives of their choice for all intents and purposes. What we do need is a set of narratives that really resituate capitalism slavery and other dynamics at the heart of the capitalist project. Going back to what people are arguing about now in history and in scholarship, like people are now understanding that capitalism is actually that American slavery or the transatlantic slave trade actually generated most of the dynamics we associated with advanced capitalism, right? And it's thing that you're right, that Roots, at least in this episode, Roots doesn't appear to get at. It definitely didn't get at it in 1977. But it's those types of pop culture projects that we actually need at this moment.
Dave, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, there's a couple things going on. One, the simple answer to the caller's question is a level of capitalism is that television, commercial network television especially, was the great image, was the great engine of post-war capitalism. They really sold us advanced consumer society. In fact, some people say that television was invented to sell Wall Street, to get people to buy credit cards, to buy new washers. That's why when you were saying you didn't get a color TV till 1977, I wanted to say, oh, Bill Paley from CBS, or no, the guy at NBC, Sarnoff, David Sarnoff, the founder of CBS, would have been very upset with you because he was selling them with women in floral-colored gowns walking around them in the 60s. So they really did, and so in a sense, the simple answer is why this remake instead of Shaka Zulu. One is because of the audience, and because people thought, well, we can remake this and be commercially successful and make money. That's the sad truth, and I think sometimes people don't, I mean, certainly the people at this conversation do, but I think sometimes viewers don't recognize how tied American commercial television is to Madison Avenue and to the economic forces in this country. I mean, it exists to sell it. And when push comes to shove, that's where they stop. Now, the saving thing is there's this, I think Douglas Kellner, maybe Kellner's the last name, wrote a great essay called The Emancipatory Power, I think, of Popular Culture. And every so often, even in this web, things break through popular culture that are liberating, that are forces, progressive forces. For example, CBS sending cameras down to the South to cover civil rights marches. All of a sudden, that's in every living room. You know, if they had thought it through, I think they would have said, oh, maybe we can't afford to send cameras. You know, that's kind of thing that happens. Roots, I think, had some of that kind of power, that emancipatory power that wasn't particularly understood going into it. And, you know, Lester gives this very sophisticated argument about where we were in some ways as a nation at that time, which is, I think, is great. Sitting in Detroit and him looking at it from his point of view, I thought, that's exactly what was going on Lafayette Boulevard when I was there.
Yeah, that's right.
It is. So that's the answer one. And I think that idea of capitalism is really important. And I won't give any spoilers away in this, but they do talk in this one a little more about how slaves as property that can get you money when you're in trouble, sort of. You know, drunken plantation owners who are horrible, you know, are not just horrible people, but they're bad business persons. Oh, well, we can use these human beings to solve our financial problems. That's really the level I saw it at,
And it's touched on a little bit. I mean, and even in the first episode when they talk about, I mean, they're clearly a commodity, and the brothers are talking about the debt that he has between them. And we thought, we said we weren't going to buy anymore, and you know, I can get more, you know, if I sell this one, then I can settle that debt or whatever, you know. So they're clearly just trading human beings for capital, and that was clear.
I'm gonna open the phones here again. It'd be interesting when we have the wrap up of this series to hear what of someone like Haile Gerima, Sankofa, I think one of the most important films ever made, thought about this series. I'm curious to see what people like that think about this as well. 410-319-8888. Back to the phones. Ernest, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm reading where Roots was plagiarized by Alex Haley. He was sued two times, and only one was successful. The original author of Roots, which was called The African Boy, was by Harold Courlander. And Haley admitted to using a lot of his information. By the way, Harold Courlander is a white male author, novelist. He used a lot of his information and put it into Roots. And a lot of the stuff that he put into Roots, the African traditions and stuff like that, was not true. And also, the genealogy, the Gambian griot and all that stuff in reference to the village where he was born, all that stuff is not, according to this article on the internet, it's not true. Even Dr. Henry Louis Gates said the fact that he traced his roots back to this village is probably not true. So I don't know how a person, it should be a caveat saying, Roots, yes, Alex Haley wrote, but he plagiarized it from another author. Well, I don't think professor or a scholarly person, if you turned in a plagiarized work at college at Hopkins, I mean, they wouldn't be talking about it and celebrating. You'd be getting an F, maybe be getting kicked out of school.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because that has been part of the saga of Roots, David Zurich.
Yeah, a couple of things on that. The statement that the caller is making, Ernest, is he plagiarized. I wouldn't be able in any way to say it with that definitive nature. And that's the nature of the Internet. You're a killer, but there was never actually, determined that you killed somebody, but somebody said it. So, A, I never felt comfortable with the evidence calling him a plagiarist. That's number one. Number two, there was an out-of-court settlement with the author you mentioned. Again, doesn't prove anything necessarily, except there was an out-of-court settlement, so you couldn't get beyond that. Number three, I have to tell you this. Having been there in the mainstream press in 1977, Haley's tremendous success when this book then came out, and then the Pulitzer Prize, and I mean, you ultimately would go on to win a Pulitzer Prize, and his miniseries. There was still in this culture, very much in the mainstream press, a kind of, it's more than backlash. It's much more complicated than that. But if a person of color, especially a black man, achieves something of that stature, the dominant mainstream press really was looking in a way to tear him down in a way that I don't think they did on an equal basis. I mean, we're skeptical and cynical, and that's our job to be a watchdog. But this was special. You remember Dr. Martin Luther King's dissertation and all the business that went on in connection with that. Somebody reached a certain level of power in our culture, and that was one of the backlash things that happened. Now, I'm not saying, again, I'm not an expert on it, and I can't tell you one way or the other what happened, but I was aware of that, and I was very careful in a sort of self-ethnographic sense. And I went back through that process again when I wrote this, and I sat with my editor, and we said, how should we handle that? And she said, the way it ultimately wound up in the paper was claims or allegations of plagiarism, comma, despite that, blah, blah, blah. This is a great piece of work. Also, this is a work, I think, of mythology. And mythology is sort of a collection of folklore, epic stories, all kinds of things in the culture. The author still has to stitch all that material together into a compelling, moving, resonant, powerful, inspiring narrative. And even if he borrowed here, here, and here, that's what happens in mythology. And he was the guy who put that all into a format, found a storyline that made it resonate the way it did. So I'm not saying, Ernest, I'm not saying the piece you have on the Internet isn't true. I'll tell you what, in my job as a reporter, and I'm a pretty hard-nosed reporter, I hope, I couldn't say what that person in the Internet said about him. He's a plagiarist. There are issues, I can tell you factually, there are issues, there were court cases, but a plagiarist, I'm not ready to call him that.
Do you, either one of you want to jump in on that, Carl, before we move to the caller or Lester?
Yeah, he settled a case out of court. So it's likely that he took passages out of the novel and out of another piece and put it into his and claimed it as his own. But I think so to that extent, calling it a piece of history would be inaccurate. And it's also possible that he embellished a lot on his ability to find the exact home of his family. But the thing is, if you look at it as kind of a piece of creative nonfiction isn't quite the word. But if you look at it as more of a myth-making enterprise, there's nothing in there that jumps out as being so wrong as it to not be worthy to be put on film.
I agree.
Yeah, and I want to underscore what David said. I mean, when a piece is successful and at upsetting, you know, the status quo as Roots was, you know, you, and especially from an African-American creator, you can expect folks to come after him. And I think a lot of the folks who are pointing the finger at this, you know, should also keep that in mind, that, you know, folks are going to come after Alex Haley for that. It was still a brilliant, beautiful piece of work.
You know, that's a great point by Carla, too, that it was upsetting. It upset people. The happy tales.
Right.
You know, Norman Mailer said slavery's our original sin, and it's the thing we can't talk about. That's why we're still so nuts. And I'm he was talking about the white culture in white America. I think that Roots said in your face, you come from really some bad roots here in this stuff. And they wanted to tear them down for that. I really agree. That's a great point, Carla.
Let's go back to the phones here. I'm sorry we missed some of these calls. Call back. We'll try to get you in. 410-319-8888. Monroe, you're on the air.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good morning.
I've been listening to a lot of conversation, and my concern is I understand Alex Haley, understand slavery. I'm proud to be black, and I will be 60 years old this year. But the thing is, there's a lot of black intellectuals in this country, and I feel we're not really looking at the problem in such a way that we can correct it and correct it permanently. Case in point, I live in Baltimore. I've seen all of these young people dying almost every day. I've had a guy last week at 7 gunshots in my car, 22 years old. And it's just getting very aggravating that we as a people don't seem to be able to analyze the situation, understand it, consume it, and create a solution. And I think we can do it. And I think the problem is we need to get out of the box, understand the game, and use the elements of the game to change the game. And I think we have that ability, but we're not doing it. We're going around in circles about our history, but we need to think about the future. I'm seeing too many of our young people dying, and it's terrible to have the elders bearing the young. And that's pretty much telling me we're bearing our future. That needs to stop. That's my comment. If there's at some point that we can have some commentary to talk about the solutions.
Well, I think if you tune in, we grab wrestle with solutions here every day and every week. There's not a week goes by we don't pour into that whole question of solutions and push very hard on those things. But I think you're right. We have to do that. So let me just take a piece of what you said, because I mean, I think that's something that's coming up again this week. We'll be doing it next week. We'll be doing it all the time. We have to deal with that reality and how we restructure the city so there's control, which can take place. And I think many political leaders are afraid to answer that question. But having heard what you said, one of the things, Lester, when I hear things about what Monroe just said, I want to twist a little bit to think about how does our understanding of the history, looking at the cultural responses to who we are, affect the kind of things Monroe is talking about? Is it too far to make that leap? I'm not so sure it is. I was thinking about my conversation with Manisha Sinha about her incredible book, The Slave's Cause, which is, I think, the best history of the abolition movement I've ever read. It gives you a perspective on that history, gives you a perspective on who we are now and the struggles we are in now when you see how the struggles were fought in this country for those 200 years. So that slavery, the narrative of slavery and enslavement also teaches us something.
Yeah, so I'm going to use a scene from Roots to talk a little bit to get at something that your caller might be dealing with. One of the problems that I think a lot of folk don't quite understand is that institutional change is incredibly hard, right? Even if we're not, and then once we add a kind of racism and class dynamics into it, it's even harder, right? So one of the things, so people routinely ask, and they ask this about slavery, like why weren't there more insurrections? Why weren't there more rebellions? Why weren't there more successes, right? You look at that attempt to take the boat, when the slaves are on the boat, or they're captives at that moment. They're captives. The African captives are on the boat, and they're trying to take it, and they end up failing, even though they have greater numbers. It's because the forces that were arrayed against them had more material strength and had more institutional power. They spoke the same language, right? That's not a dynamic of culture. That's not black people not knowing. That's not black people not figuring it out. That's just them being faced with superior strength, with superior numbers. That's the first thing. The second thing is I talked earlier about what Roots needs to do now. The reason I talk about what Roots needs to do now versus 1977 is because our present shapes how we view the past and what we need the past for, right? And if you go, so going back, it's not a coincidence that scholars are starting to understand the role slavery played in capitalism again as capitalism is starting to fail. Right, it's not a coincidence that that the best-selling books about slavery over the last few years all take that approach. So there's something to be said for folks in general trying to problem solve what we need, trying to figure out what it is we do to keep more kids from being killed and more elders burying their kids. But there are a number of folks that are doing that, and then in a program like Roots, if properly structured. Again, I haven't seen the rest. Can actually help us, can help us as opposed to keep us to keeping us distracted from more contemporary questions.
That's really well said, Carla.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in addition, another institution that is often seen as failing, in addition to capitalism, is basically the family, in particular the black family. And I think this being this saga, and you know, the original tagline for Roots was the saga of an American family. If we still, and again, I don't know how it plays out in the rest of the episodes, but if it still really focuses on this family and how it continues to tell its story and tries and fights to hold itself together. I think those are lessons I think we're all looking, you know, to learn from, as far as, you know, because at the end of the day, and it kind of goes back to what they talked about in the village, you know, it's about building and maintaining your family, which is nation building. I mean, if that's what we're talking about needing to do, those are lessons that, you know, we can look to the past to try to figure out how do we do it. I found that a lot of the conversations I have now, it's about that struggle, about, you know, the family unit, whether it is traditional family, but whatever family community unit happens in the space that you are, is critical to being a part of a larger structure where they're, you know, just different spokes, you know, hubs and spokes on a ever larger, you know, kind of, you know, gears and wheel, you know what I mean? So I think that's something we learned from this story.
Yeah, I think that those were really important comments, because I think that we are, you know, when you look at this also, this story in the context of things that have been made more recently, I mean, from Sankofa being made in 1993, which I mentioned earlier, but just new TV series like The Underground, or Underground, not Underground.
The WGN series.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Underground? No, wait a minute. That's not what it's called. Yeah. Is it?
It's the it's WGN.
It is. Okay. I lost my mind for a moment. It's back now. But I think that this idea, at least whether it's the new Roots or the new films that are coming out, is the sense of empowerment in the stories about the period of enslavement. And it's about the story of people struggling and being leadership of struggling for their own liberation. Those two pieces have always gotten left out. And that's the kind of narrative I think has been that Roots allowed to take place in media that did not take place before, when it challenged the hegemony of Gone with the Wind and Birth of a Nation. And that, to me, is the kind of critical historical role it played culturally, for all the critique you might want to give it.
You know, this is, you know, back, I'm old enough when the television was just thought of as a frivolity, an entertainment thing, even though it was selling this ideology, you know? And this is why I went into it, because I believe television is this deep and this profound in some ways. And maybe it's only Lester and Carla's being deep and profound that made this sound this way. But you have this show, and it's helping engender critiques about capitalism and family, like we just heard from Lester and Carla, okay? You scratch America deep enough, and it's always about money. It's always about – that's who we are, capitalism, sad to say. No matter what, our media, anything, in the end, that's what the culture produces. It's changing, I think, in some ways because it's being forced on them, but – and family. This show, this primetime entertainment, quote, television, can engender that kind of discussion about our reality. That's a powerful, that's a worthwhile television production. I mean, that's my bottom line on it. If, you know, it doesn't do it on its own, but if it can help trigger that kind of discussion. Now, I said, Lester and Carla, and your show opens it up for this. But when you think about how the ecosystem of media in this country, the fact that this discussion then comes the morning after that show, that's an important television show.
No, I think, and for me, it was really important to kind of wrestle with this, and why I'm so anxious to see how we, where this ends up, yeah, in four episodes, and what we can say about that after these four episodes, and kind of wrestle with what we've seen, and also just the, I think the changing landscape of the media, and the things people are seeing on television, and how that's affecting the dialogue, and how it also, in some ways, is also affecting the world of Trump.
You got another hour.
We'll do that in a few days. First of all, I want to just thank our guests. This has been really a phenomenal conversation. It's always good to have you with us. Carla Wills, senior news producer at Democracy Now! You're doing great work, and we'll see each other soon, I hope.
Definitely, Mark. I hope so. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you here. And Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media, Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. A latest book, Knocking the Hustle Against a Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. And I think one of our leading thinkers anywhere in this country. Lester, good to have you with us once again.
Yeah, good to be here. I'll talk to you soon.
It's very soon. And my friend, Dr. David Zurwick. I love that. Dr. David Zurwick, who, of course, is the Baltimore Sun Media Critic, Assistant Professor in the Department of Communication and Media Studies at Goucher. Always good to have you, David. Thanks so much
for being here. Thank you. Oh, it was a privilege to be part of this discussion, Mark.
Don't be a stranger. Come on back. It's good having you here.
Only live a couple blocks away.
That's good. That's a good thing. And thank you all for calling in and writing in and making the show what it is. Wouldn't be anything without you. On our way out of here, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. And thank you all for calling in, and keep us posted about what you're thinking. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org to give us your ideas. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producers are Stephanie Myronis and Mark Gunry. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org and your ideas for future programs. To podcast Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.